Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. We've been studying Zechariah. This afternoon, we want to look at chapter 8. Chapter 8 is a continuance of the section in Zechariah that has to deal with the children of Israel asking if they should carry on with the fasts that they had held in their captivity in Babylon. The expositor speaks of the children of Israel seeing good harvests at this time and seeing the fruits of their labor through the direction of God in building the temple. Chapter 8 specifically deals with two things: the hope of Israel and the answer to the question in chapter 7 on whether or not they should keep these fasts. The time period that the children of Israel were in during this time was marked with bountiful harvests and joy in the land. They had some success building the temple and could see the results from their labor. It is said that this time period is a type of the future age that we are all seeking, at Christ's return, as Jerusalem is the center of the world. What a wonderful prophecy. We hope to all be deemed worthy at this time and take part of the work that will begin: the subduing of the nations and the construction of New Jerusalem. The chapter opens with the verse, "Again the word of Yahweh of hosts came to me saying." This militant title for God we see four times in this chapter. Yahweh of armies is the interpretation, and it means he who will become armies. It is prophetic of the way that Jerusalem will be restored and mankind subdued through the multitudinous Christ. The march of the rainbowed angel that is mentioned in the Apocalypse. Verse 3 says, "Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury." Great jealousy emphasizes the divine emotion, for Yahweh has an absolute affection for the place that he selected above all others to place his name. Zion represents the foundation of the prophecy of Zechariah, significantly appearing 8 times, the number of the covenant. It was a site of the throne of Melchizedek, king priest of Salem in the days of Abraham, who received blessings from the superior monarch. Zion is situated on the hills of Moriah, where the great sacrifice of Abraham was enacted, typical of the work of God and his Son, through whom the promised blessings would extend to all peoples. When he led the redeemed people from Egypt, Moses foresaw God's elevation of Zion as the mountain of thine inheritance, the sanctuary which thy hands have established. So the verse mentions God's jealousy for her with great fury. We have seen the punishment that Israel has endured as we see the nations around them oppressing them through the Father. We also see the punishment that those nations that oppress Israel had to deal with because they sought it for their own personal gain and not the will of the Father. The world focuses on a forgiving God. There is no doubt that we believe in a forgiving God, but we know the true God, the God that punishes wickedness and disciplines his sons and daughters. And do we not aspire to be sons of God and not bastards? So we welcome the chastisement and the polishing of our rough edges, or do we? I know that I have a lot of work to do when it comes to this. It is easy to get down when God is working with us and see it as a negative. The fleshly side of us wants to pursue fleshly goals. It's gatherings like this that help us to take a step back and see what's really important in life. It's not our own fleshly goals that we set for ourselves. It is enjoying the blessings that God has given us and praying that we are acting according to his will. So the opening to this chapter gives us the assurance that God is and will be reverenced, that he will not forget his people, but that he demands respect, and that if we stumble, we will be punished. So that's an important point. Before the assurance and great hope comes a reminder that it's not without perseverance that his grace will be extended to his people. The next section of this chapter reminds us where the kingdom will be set up. It says in verse 3, "Thus saith Yahweh, I am returned unto Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem." The word dwell means to permanently abide. Yahweh abode in the tabernacle in the midst of Israel in the past and in Solomon's temple, but was absent from Zerubbabel's temple. This Shekinah glory will exist in the temple of the kingdom age in Jerusalem. So we have another reassurance. The kingdom will be set up on earth, not up in heaven, but on this earth. The next few verses of the chapter gives us some insight into what it will be like. It will be called a city of truth. It will be set apart and elevated above mankind. The next verse says, "There shall yet be old men and old women." The older age mentioned signifies the longevity of immortal life. The second part of that verse looks like a contrast at first. It says, "And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing." We see the happiness in this picture. We see our kids playing on the playground here on the grounds. Their energy is exciting. It seems like they could and do play for hours at a time. The older that we get, the more we realize how great it would be to have that kind of energy. That is what this speaks of. How great will it be in the kingdom to not have to worry about the ailments of our frail, aging bodies? So we have the picture of wisdom of age and the energy of youth. Verse 6 goes on to say, "If it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes?" What this verse is saying is that as hard as it may seem to picture this, with all the wickedness and the shape that the world is in, that what is impossible with man is totally possible and will be a reality with the deity. God will realize his plan. We see this in the next verses. "Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness." What a beautiful picture and hope for each and every one of us here to be part of this. We know that God will save his people. It's our hope to be included in his people at the judgment. In verses 9 through 13, Zechariah explains that the blessings that they were enduring at that time serves as an example of the blessings that are coming in the kingdom age, and that they should be motivated to remain strong in faith and not waver when faced with difficulties. It says, "Fear not, but let your hands be strong." We shouldn't shy away from our work in the truth because of fear. If God is for us, who will be against us? It's an inverse relationship. The more fear we have of our Heavenly Father, the less fear of the world we will have. The more fear or dependence we have on the world, the less we will fear and depend on our Father. This encouragement given in this section was the same encouragement that was given to the people under Joshua as they entered the land. We see the result of their fear and dependence on the world around them. I know that I read Scripture and think, how can they have done this or that? And we fall in the same trap from time to time. In verses 14 through 17, the people are instructed not to fear the future because of the captivity they had just gone through. That God will restore Jerusalem in the future. To learn from their fathers and to learn and obey God's commands. The fathers of the people of this time failed, and God punished them. Through Zechariah, God was telling the nation to relish in God's mercy. But closely behind, he was telling them what they should do. Not to rest on their laurels and get lazy. To enjoy the blessings, but pursue continually righteousness. He says, "To speak ye every man the truth to his neighbor." They were commanded to speak the truth in a manner pleasing to the Father. We know that the tongue that we use to speak is deceitful among all the members. It is through our tongue that we sin. He says to execute the judgment of truth. You know, to live their lives as closely to the truth as they could. These are powerful words. To execute the judgment of truth means to constantly being thoughtful about our actions. To pray that our actions be in accordance with His will. To pray for God's guidance and to act on it when He gives it to you. Because that is what we will be judged on, brothers and sisters. How we reacted to the situation that God has put in front of us. The next verse mentions peace in your gates. The expositor mentions that peace is shalom, the common greeting shared by Jews today, and signifies to be at one, united, to share a common welfare. That is what we should be doing today. This is fellowship, isn't it? To ensure that we are united and all pushing to the main goal, to be part of the kingdom age and the glorification of our Father in heaven. Verse 17 states, "And let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor, and love no false oath." Why were they not supposed to do this? The answer follows, "For all these things are things that I hate, saith Yahweh." So they were instructed to speak the truth, do the truth, and think the truth, instead of just going through the motions of the fast. So with proper understanding of how they should approach their walk in the truth, the fasts were converted into joyful festivities. The significance to me of the fasts turning into feasts is symbolic of their walk in the truth as well as ours. It is and should be with much joy that we approach our walk in the truth. Not with complaining or negativity that we have been elected to a position in the ecclesia or have been asked to help. There really is no reason that we shouldn't approach our walk with joy if you stop to think about it. We have been given the greatest opportunity that anyone can have. But our joy is also the example to the world around us. If they see the joy that we are all sharing and helping one another, or just the joy radiating from us being in the truth, it may be what it takes to convince them, if they are called, to act upon their calling. The flesh seeks happiness. We can see all the empty happiness that the worldly activities bring. The world is hurting, and it's safe to say that it's not happy. All you have to do is just hear a brief snippet of the news to hear this. All the wickedness and vileness that is in the world is a result from unhappiness or seeking happiness in a place that it will not be found. We are representatives of the true Christ and the truth. It is our duty to keep up with the joy that the truth brings, to help each other remember the joy that we should be exhibiting. I know that anyone brought to these high grounds would see the happiness and togetherness that we all share. It's inviting. And we need to remember that we are representatives and greet our visitors. You just never know the result from the beginning. I can tell you that I remember the times that brothers and sisters approached me before I came into the truth with a welcoming spirit. There are many brothers and sisters that are welcoming. One brother particularly comes to mind. He walks up and speaks to every visitor that comes through the door. And it's not just out of obligation that he does this. No one can tell that he felt like he should be coming up and saying hi or glad that you made it. He is genuinely happy that the visitor is there. It is this compassion and joyful approach to the truth that we should all be seeking and working on. Verses 20 through 23 touch on this transformation of fast into feast, being prophetic of the future age in the kingdom. The desire for truth and praise of Yahweh will be contagious. We see in verse 21, "One city shall go to another, saying, Let us go speedily to pray before Yahweh and to seek Yahweh of hosts." We see in verse 23 that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages of the nations. 10 signifies completeness and is not literally 10 men. Out of all the languages means that nations will be subdued and unified and one language will be left. So we come to the end of the chapter. This chapter is filled with the glorious hope that we all share in a new Jerusalem. With all the cares and worries and wickedness that is in this present world going away, it precludes this glorious picture with a reminder of how the children of Israel had gotten to the point that they were in. How they had failed to fear Yahweh and reverence His name. Isaiah chapter 65 is similar to this chapter in prophecy. Similar to other views of the glorious kingdom and the path to life, we always see the true faith is mixed and predicated on fear. This true faith is not a blind faith, but a faith filled with joy serving our Master. If we forget about the pursuits of this world and focus on glorifying our Father in heaven, we hope that through grace we might have a place in His kingdom. I will leave you with a few verses in Isaiah 65. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered, nor come into mind. But be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing, and her people a joy. And I will rejoice in Jerusalem, and joy in my people. And the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying. There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner, being 100 years old, shall be accursed. And they shall build houses and inhabit them. And they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands.
Thank you, Justin, for those remarks. Zechariah chapter 8 is now open for discussion. Brother Dan?
First of all, I'd like to thank Brother Justin for once again doing another great job. Did a great job in Richard as well, and if you get a chance, you should listen to the tapes. But a very good explanation of the chapter we're studying. Just wanted to note again the contrast that the fast that we're presented in this morning's class in chapter 7, where the people were asking about the fasts, and God had said, "Are you doing these to me? Are you really doing these for me?" And He knew that they weren't. They were doing them for themselves. And the contrast that He was trying to show now is brought out here in the final chapters, as Justin brought out the fast of the 4th, the 5th, the 7th, and the 10th month. Where it seems here for three things, and He's got for joy and gladness and cheerful feasts. That was the first aspect of it. God wanted this to be a joyous occasion. And the second thing was, He says, therefore, love truth and peace. And that was the second thing. So what were they rejoicing over and glad about and being cheerful about? Well, it was because they were to love the truth and to love peace. It was a reflection upon those things. And the third item then would be in verse 20, where He says, and bring people. We need the inhabitants of the land to be able to also join in this. So there is to be a rejoicing over the truth with the peoples. And he leaves it off. He says, therefore, let us go at once to entreat the favor of the Lord and seek the Lord of hosts. And He finishes it off by saying, I'm going. Are you coming? So it was to be a joyful thing. God was putting forth the answer to the questions brought out in chapter 7.
Brother Philip, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I'd like to add my thanks to Brother Justin for outlining that chapter for us, continuing the thoughts, as Brother Dan has said, from chapter 7 this morning. My thoughts went to the verse that he drew our attention to early on in his remarks. In verse 3, thus saith Yahweh, I am returned unto Zion and would dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And Brother Justin referred to that word dwell and the meaning of the word dwell. I might have missed his reference back. If I have, I apologize for that. But that word dwell in the Hebrew is shakan. And we get the idea which we've had referred to a couple of times this week, the Shekinah glory. The glory of the deity as it shone forth between the cherubim in the most holy place. It was present in the tabernacle and Solomon's temple, not particularly in the temple that was being built here. But the verse which I must admit always impresses me, in I think it's Exodus chapter 25, when we think of the great creator of the universe, you know, and today we are able to get some idea of his greatness when we consider the universe, you know, the telescopes and that, they blow our minds when they sort of like tell us how large the universe is and the various galaxies and things. He's the creator of it. He's clothed with majesty and with might. He stretched out the heavens as a garment. He is supreme, the great deity of the universe. And yet in Exodus chapter 25, where he gives command to the children of Israel to make them make me a tabernacle, and he says, in a few of the opening verses, maybe verse 5 or 6, he said, let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And it's the same word, I understand, shakan, to dwell. And we're greatly impressed with the great creator of the universe wanting to dwell with man. It's his great desire to dwell with mankind. That's not without realizing upon his principles. The very construction of the tabernacle, the way which Yahweh held the people back, they couldn't just come and approach his holy presence. There was a priesthood, and even amongst the priesthood there was one man, the high priest. It was very much keeping the children of Israel at arm's length. There was an appropriate approach. But nevertheless, it was the deity's desire to dwell with man. And I think the comments that Brother Justin and with Brother Robin this morning, with these principles and the spirit of the truth, teach us the way he desires to do that, with keeping mercy, executing righteous judgments, and as Brother Dan has emphasized, you're loving the truth, that we saturate our minds with the principles, with the spirit word which is before us. And in doing so, Our minds and our characters then are being molded into the principles of the truth. It's Brother Thomas at various places in his exposition says about the three developments, that the three points of development that Yahweh has with his people are intellectual, moral, and ultimately physical. That the intellectual appreciation of the truth dwells in our minds and morally changes our lives to be fashioned like unto the character of his dear Son, which in turn is the character of the Father revealed for ourselves. And ultimately then, made like unto the nature of the deity, immortal and incorruptible. Brother Thomas, as we commented many times, expressed it in one of the heralds, saying, God manifestation, not human salvation, is the great principle of the eternal spirit. The salvation of the multitude was incidental to the purpose, but was not the end proposed. So his great theme, and the theme of scriptures, is to manifest the principles and character of the deity. And as we've had various comments in the chapters, Israel did fail. And from time to time we see their failures. And they're there not for us to take a high ground, but to learn from it and to develop those principles which would be pleasing to him.
Brother Burrell.
Brother Philip said a lot of what I was going to say, but I'd like to just add a couple of things to what he said, and also adding my thanks to Brother Justin. As Brother Justin pointed out, Israel was kind of prospering a little bit now, and they had been through a period of trial and tribulation, and they expected a land with milk and honey, and they had to work for it, and their enemies got the upper hand for a while. But you know, God was with this, and so God sent a way of comfort and a way of exhortation and a way of upbuilding. And Ezra tells us how he did it. Ezra, the 6th chapter, the 14th verse, he said, "The elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai and the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo." That's how they did it. And as Brother Philip said, the word of God became the forefront on their mind. It was what they thought about. It was what was on their mind. It was on the forefront of their mind. It was the thing that they thought about, the thing that they filled their mind with. And we can see that, you know, with the prophecy that we read today, as they commented on the third verse. You know, that's what God put in their mind. That's what the prophets told them. That's what strengthened them to the work. That's what brought them back around. And so if we keep this on our minds, we'll be strengthened also. We don't have time. We don't have room in our minds to keep a lot of garbage. You know, we've got to fill our minds with the Word. We've got to fill our minds with the commandments of Christ and keep the promises in the forefront. We know what they are. They're our hope. Without keeping them in the forefront of our mind, we're going to fail. That's what our minds should be filled with, is the things of the kingdom.
Brother Johnny?
Brothers and sisters, this chapter opens with God saying something very profound. He uses the word jealousy. We normally, as Americans, use the word, think of jealousy as perhaps obsessive possessions that were fanatical. Well, it means the same. God is fanatical for Israel, for Jerusalem. And he says, "I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury." That God's position as to Jerusalem and Zion and the establishing of his will on earth has not changed a bit. As time goes on, eventually his fury that he speaks of there, his fury will come up in his face, and he will establish his will. We know that God has directed the event so that there is a nation of Israel there now, but even in that, they are interlopers. They are only part-time rulers, and they will be removed, and the true saints set up in power with Christ. And so it's interesting to realize that God doesn't love Israel just a little. It's his whole plan and purpose is to have Israel and Jerusalem the capital of the world, and that will be established through great fury, great jealousy, and his will not be undaunted.
Brother Ben?
Just a quick comment, and I also wish to thank Brother Justin for his remarks. Just something that he said sparked a thought in my mind, and certainly I don't claim to know much about Hebrew, but when he mentioned about the word shalom, which, as he said, it's not necessarily, you know, you see people, they might say shalom when they're greeting somebody. It's not necessarily just a greeting like we would say hello. It conveys that idea of peace and unity almost. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go on a trip to Israel, and it wasn't uncommon to see trinkets, almost touristy type things, you know, and it would say shalom on there, or postcards, it would say shalom. And yet we think of the place where, in Jerusalem, what it's like today, and it's exactly the opposite of what that word is trying to convey. That there is no peace and unity in that city now. And yet we have at the end of this chapter, these last four verses, verses 20 to the end, we have this vision, not vision, but we have this, what it will be like in the future. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, "Let us go speedily," or the margin says, "continually to pray before Yahweh." To think that people will continually go to Yahweh to look for answers. Many people and strong nations shall come to seek Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem. What are they seeking in Jerusalem today? They're seeking their own benefit. They want to destroy, most countries want to destroy Israel, and for their own benefit, for oil or for what have you. And of course that last verse, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. That's something that we just don't see today and that we look forward to seeing in the future. You walk through Jerusalem today and you can just feel that there's a sense of tension. Even though it may not be spoken, you can just feel that there's tension among the people that are there, between the Jews and the Arabs. And yet we know that we look forward to the day when these things of the last four verses of this chapter will come to pass.
Brother Pat?
Face it this way? Okay. Me and microphones don't get along too well. point of fact. We're going to be getting into Zechariah 12, and it's going to mention, I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone. All that words to that effect, all who mess with it will end up broken to pieces. And we do see
more of that today than anything else. I think that's a good hope, because
Brother Phil?
I just wanted to make a point of suggestion on verse 7 for us to think about by way of discussion. And thus saith Yahweh Sabaoth, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country. We probably, most of us, if all of us, are familiar with Brother Thomas's exposition, The Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land Explained, which is an excellent little publication, describing the restoration of Israel. And in that exposition, Brother Thomas makes reference to Isaiah chapter 11 and a host of other scriptures as well. But Isaiah chapter 11 and the concluding verses, where he talks about destroying the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and smiting the river and the seven streams thereof. And Brother Thomas suggests that this would be the way in which the children of Israel, we know Judah will be in the land, and they will have already lost 2/3 of the population, of course, by the king of the north coming down upon them. But the work of Elijah will then be knit in the hearts of the children to the fathers, and the Elijah will be going, and maybe this verse is indicating to us, to the east and to the west, possibly symbolic of universal aspects of the Jews being brought back from the whole world. But Brother Thomas was suggesting that the tongue of the Egyptian sea and the river Euphrates both would be made fordable. I think was the I don't mean affordable, I mean fordable, easily to pass over. The waters would be dried up, which Brother Thomas indicates that it's not necessary to do that for the saints, but it will be for the mortal Jews who will come from the east and the west. So the kind of picture that seems to be suggested in our exposition is that that Elijah will bring them from the areas that will come from Europe, maybe. Apocalypse chapter 18 says, "Come out of her, my people, that he be not partaker of his sins." That the children of Israel fighting their way back through Catholic Europe and the hostilities there will be ultimately brought down into Egypt, and even from maybe the territories of the north, coming down from the Euphratian area, that the Euphrates will be made passable, so that the Jews come back by the work of Elijah from the east and from the west, and will be there ready to go then back up into the land and be reunited with Judah when they go up on the east side of Jordan and actually cross over Jordan, and the valley of Achor will become a door of hope, Petah Tikvah, to the house of Israel, and then that glory will dwell in it. So a couple of interesting thoughts there. Behold, I'll save my people from the east country, from the west country, maybe indicating to us the direction and the work that Elijah will effect to bring the people of Israel back.
Brother Matt? Matthew?
Just to give a quick thanks to Brother Justin and all who followed with comments afterwards. I just have a quick comment to make. Linking back to the prophecy of Haggai, because this prophecy of the 8th chapter connected with the 7th chapter was in the 4th year of King Darius, in the 9th month. Now in Haggai, the last prophecy of Haggai was 2 months previous on the same month, and some of what Haggai was saying actually corresponded to what Zechariah was saying in this chapter. They had not been blessed. He said that in verse 10, "Before those days there was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast, neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction. For I set all men, every one against his brother." And likewise in Haggai, Haggai's message basically was summarized in those words, "Consider your ways." He was saying, "Is it time, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house, the temple, lie waste?" They were getting their priorities askew. They were there back in the land, and perhaps in caught up with the spirit of things, joyful to be back in their land, they'd forgotten that their obligations were first and foremost to be concentrating on the work that the house of Yahweh demanded. And consider now, from this day and upward, he said, from the 24th day of the 9th month, so 2 months previously, even from the day that the foundation of Yahweh's temple was laid, and consider it. And he went on to say how that they had been blessed following those endeavours. He said, "Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree hath not brought forth. From this day will I bless you." And whilst our situation is not like Israel's, we're not re-establishing a commonwealth, we're not establishing a kingdom in Israel, we've got work to do building the spiritual temple. And what we've got to remember is, if we want God to bless us, we have to put him first. It's no point trying to serve ourselves and then wondering why perhaps we're not finding the blessings upon our endeavours in the truth, if we're not giving our wholehearted efforts into the enterprise. And I think it also gives us just a brief glimpse of that glorious time to come, which Justin presented to us, and others since have presented to us, that time when Israel will be blessed, and when Christ returns, that will be the last time that they will ever disobey God's commandments. Of course, we look beyond that time to when there shall be no other nations. God will make a full end of all nations whither he scattered the Jews. "Yet will I not make a full end of thee," he says. And in that day, spiritual Jerusalem will basically encapsulate everyone in that day, and all nations, all the factions between nations that have subsisted since the beginning will all be at an end, and there will be that peace and that unity prevailing throughout the earth, just like that word shalom, which we've been discussing also.
there any more comments? Brother Phil?
Brothers and sisters, I don't want to hog the discussion here, but thought I might just make a comment for us to think about again. In verse 23, that said, the Ali Sabaeth, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that Elohim is with you. Brother Pat made reference to the anti-Semitic behaviours that are apparent. It's interesting that Brother Pat has made reference to that, because Europe is infested with anti-Semitism, and it's growing at a rate of knots. And you know, we are people who love the Jews, even though they're there in unbelief of the Messiah, and blindness in part has happened to them. We love the Jews, and it's characteristic of our movement since the inception of it in the days of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts that we do love the people, God's people. And what a glorious thing to look forward to when we see them elevated from the tail, as another prophecy says, to the head, and to receive the honour of the nations that they actually greatly desire to associate themselves with the Jews, because at last Jewry themselves have accepted the Messiah, and they see the blessings associated with that. I wonder whether there is a thought association as well in that last part, we have heard that God is with you. It will be patently obvious that the deity has blessed them abundantly. That heart of stone will have been removed. They will be given a heart of flesh, which is recipient of the principles of his salvation, and God is with them. And I wonder whether there is a thought link there, considering the chapter 7 to 12 of Isaiah, the Emmanuel prophecies, God with us. That's, you know, and Matthew chapter 1 indicates that his name shall be called Jesus, God with us. The deity manifested in Christ is apparent there in the crown of the whole age, the Messiah reigning before his angels gloriously, receiving the honour in the very place where he was humiliated. They will see God with us. They will see that God is with them. Christ will rule as King of Kings and Lord of Lords.